TNT Radio wants to know what you really think. From COVID-19, the Ukraine conflict, the persecution of Julian Assange, corrupt government, the WEF, digital IDs and digital currency, the Great Reset, the disassembling of the West, and the destruction of the world as we once knew it. Your opinion matters. It's time to get on our soapbox and tell us what you really think at TNTRadio.live. Upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. Thanks for listening and for being a part of Jason Q's Citizen and Friends on today's news talk radio, TNT.
And we're back for the second hour, and it's wonderful to have a former premier or a governor or somebody of that qualification and standing to come onto this program and this station and be able to tell us from the bottom of his heart what he really thinks about what's going on. And what's better is that we don't necessarily agree on everything. And I'll challenge Campbell Newman, and he will happily defend, but he might not necessarily agree. That's okay. And that's why we're here. I'm not going to go crazy, and I'm not going to push him on all sorts of areas and make it nuts, but the idea is we're looking for a middle ground. And what I found fascinating about that interview was the fact that he's saying that the Liberal Party now needs to move towards the Freedom Parties and give up some ground, just as the Freedom Parties need to listen and also give up some ground, because we can't keep electing left-wing, crazy Labour globalist parties into power and give up what we have. Politics is a case of moving. The idea of it being perfect is not possible. Politics is a nasty business. It's a blood sport. And if we're going to get into the game and be a blood sport, we need to consolidate. And I think that the interview with Campbell Newman was as good as any that you would get on mainstream news these days, because no one really gets to speak the truth. So keep going here at TNT. Keep listening and keep telling your friends. And also tell them that Nicola Charles, the White Rabbit, was on air today as well. You won't be hearing her on Sky News, will you? Absolutely not. Now, an article has popped up today that literally blew my mind. MIT, that's the Massachusetts Institute of Technology researchers, are building swarms of tiny robots that have built-in intelligence, allowing them to build structures, vehicles, or even larger versions of themselves. That's right. They're going to build robots to give birth to robots. The subunit of the robot, which is being built at MIT's Center for Bits and Atoms, is called a voxel, V-O-X-E-L, and is capable of carrying power and data. When we're building these structures, you have to build in intelligence, MIT professor director Neil Gershenfeld said in a statement. What emerged was the idea of structural electronics, of making voxels that transmit power and data as well as force. The voxels make up both the robot itself as well as the components of the thing being built, allowing them to work together on larger structures. It could build a structure, or it could build another robot of the same size, or it could build a bigger robot, CBA doctoral student Amira Abdul Rahman said in another statement. While the researching is promising, it will be likely years before we see self-replicating robot swarms, according to Gershenfeld. The researchers, who published a paper laying out the findings in Nature, are working with the aviation industry, car companies, and NASA on the new technology. What could possibly go wrong, and why do we need it? That story was published in the New York Post. Do you yearn for a return simply to personal responsibility, to not sublease your risk profile to the government and compulsorily? I know I do. Now, considering this article, it prompted me to ask myself a few questions. Is the trans agenda the softening of boundaries so that society accepts sentient AI robots as people with thoughts, feelings, and rights? If so, then humans will literally compete with artificial intelligence and seemingly mingle, befriend, and love. Yep, this is real. But AI will not get sick or need to be paid or even eat and drink. So why would the powers that be need humans at that point? Is the developing of artificial intelligent robots to make humans want for nothing, to become unproductive and fat, for our benefit so we can consume the spoils of the robots' labor? Certainly not. It may be inevitable, and it may take us down a path no one is ready to discuss, let alone accept. But all the huffing and puffing to keep us safe with malperforming safe medicine, humans will have to take medicines that AI simply will not require for necessary or unnecessary reasons, but enforced nonetheless. Adjustment in the new world may be the cover for the new list of ailments appearing as a result of medicines, but of course blamed on novel excuses like stress. And we saw a paper come out recently that said that the heart attacks and strokes caused by the vaccine were caused by vaccine anxiety, causing vessels to constrict, and that's why people were having said heart attacks and strokes. Be careful what you pay for. Humanity is making itself redundant. And unlike what Campbell said, I think it's not by accident. And it turns out today, Elon Musk has tweeted that we are now confident that the Neuralink device is ready for humans, so timing is a function of working through the FDA approval process. This is putting a chip in your head to link your body with a computer. So for all the good work Musk is doing for free speech, on the other side of the fence, he's running us into a pathway of the mark of the beast. I won't be playing in that game at all. In fact, I'll die for it. Did you know there are many ways you can listen to TNT Radio? Why not stream us direct from our website on your desktop, tablet, or mobile device, or download our app from the App Store? We even stream live on YouTube, Rumble, and Odyssey. We've got you covered on TNT Radio.
Stream us anywhere.
I listen on Alexa.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Brazilian president-elect, and we say that loosely, Luiz Lula da Silva, has demanded Julian Assange's release. I can't believe it, Darren. What's going on?
Yeah, I saw this article yesterday as I was preparing for the shows today, and I was taken aback. I thought, wow, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has met with WikiLeaks representatives in the Brazil capital, Brasilia. Brazilian President Lula da Silva has called for the release of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange from the British maximum security prison, Belmarsh. Assange has been detained since 2019 and is awaiting extradition to the US, where he faces up to 175 years in prison over the publication of classified materials, also known as journalism. Taken to Twitter on Tuesday, Lula posted a photo of himself shaking hands with WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Kristin Hrafnsson, with WikiLeaks ambassador Joseph Farrell standing nearby. The whistleblowing organization's top representatives arrived in the Latin American country expecting to also hold a meeting with Brazilian lawmakers. According to the accompanying text, the two informed the Brazilian official about Julian Assange's health situation and fight for freedom. Lula da Silva in turn asked his guest to convey his solidarity to the imprisoned WikiLeaks founder. He also expressed hope that Assange would be released from his unfair imprisonment. In his own tweet, Hrafnsson said that he had a private meeting with the Brazilian president-elect. And it must be noted, he is president-elect. There are challenges to his result in the recent Brazilian elections, whom he thanked for his ongoing support and described as a true man of passion, vision, and sympathy. Several media outlets reported that the WikiLeaks delegation was planning to meet with Humberto Costa, the president of the Human Rights Commission of the Brazilian Senate, as well as lawmakers from the lower chamber on Tuesday. The whistleblower's representatives allegedly discussed with the MPs a number of steps that the latter could take, including sending a letter to the US embassy in Brasilia urging Washington to drop the charges against Assange. And I'm sure that'll go straight into that, the filing cabinet of I will never look at that later. Lula da Silva, who was elected as president in late October in a tight race against incumbent right-wing president Jair Bolsonaro, has long been a vocal supporter of Assange. Assange has been in Britain's Belmarsh High Security Prison since April 2019, when he was removed from the Ecuadorian embassy in London after Quito, which is the capital of Ecuador, revoked his asylum status. The journalist, whose health has severely deteriorated in UK custody, awaits extradition to the US, where he faces 175-year sentence on charges of leaking secret documents he received from a US Army analyst alleging US war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. No, they showed quite clearly US war crimes. WikiLeaks supporters insist that Assange was simply practicing journalism by publishing the documents, which were redacted to remove some sensitive information. Activists claim Washington retaliated against the outlet and its founder for exposing its own war crimes. Very strange story. Is Lula trying to maybe get some support from those that believe he cheated in the election, that the election in Brazil was rigged, that Bolsonaro actually won the election? Maybe. It's also sort of a case of gesture politics, Jason, where he goes, yeah, I'm gonna send a harshly worded letter to the US embassy in Brasilia and ask them to release Assange and drop all the charges, knowing damn well the chances of that are almost zero. In fact, they probably are zero. Like I said, I'm sure the Americans will read the letter and stick it straight in the bin, because there's absolutely zero chance they're ever going to let Assange get off for exposing what they did in Iraq and in Afghanistan and elsewhere, and the other information that WikiLeaks continues to pour out, which contravenes narratives we have always been told about the behavior of our the people in power, Jason.
You make some very, very good points there, Darren. The idea that all of a sudden the great threat to the establishment, Julian Assange himself, is somehow now to be protected by the woke president-elect of Brazil and the woke newspapers of the New York Times, Der Spiegel, and others around the world, all of a sudden are now pro-Assange's release. It does play very much like what they're trying to do is bolster support, because all they need to do is get people to come across and go, yay, 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 these people are fantastic. And all they then need to do is to not let him out. And of course, the people would have been conned, betrayed yet again. And worse, Julian Assange's own health goes down the toilet even further. His wife Stella and his two little kids sit there and suffer, of course. And interestingly, here in Australia, silence as usual from our gutless government that wants to say nothing and has never said anything about one of their own stuck in prisons on the other side of the planet for simply trying to reveal the truth in all of it. And one wonders again if it is that maybe what they do is they play for his release, but part of his release is his silence. And something tells me that if he was never going to give up his source that we all knew was Seth Rich in all of this, for that massive situation that went over there in the United States that resulted in Seth's own murder, that many, many suspicious clues have come out in all of it, well, why would he all of a sudden bargain now for his release? Is it because they think he's getting old and he's frail? One thinks that Assange is going to sort of sit above all of that. So we have yet another war brewing, don't we?
It makes you wonder how much influence and how much power does the US administration have over the rest of the world? Because this Brazilian president-elect Lula has come out and said and spoken against the situation with Assange, but you don't get it from the UK government, you don't get it from the Australian government, you don't really hear many voices coming out of Europe, Canada, and so on. And, you know, it just goes to demonstrate what a bully the US is, and how they don't like being exposed for their quite heinous crimes. One of the videos that Assange released, WikiLeaks released, was the video of those journalists and civilians being shot up by an Apache helicopter. In my own country, we're supposed to be about fairness, freedom of speech, democracy, all these buzzwords that get chucked around willy-nilly now these days. And yet there's a journalist who's been sat and probably being treated awfully in one of the toughest prisons in the UK. I don't know where this story goes with regards to Assange. I suspect he's probably going to die in jail. The repercussions of that are people who want to release the truth about the behavior of our governments are going to be fearful to do so.
Now, in all of this, when we're watching, observing from literally from 35,000 feet, the Balenciaga story is massive just on its own. This, at the exact same time that the Assange story emerges, and of course it was Julian Assange through his WikiLeaks that released the Podesta files that kicked off Pizzagate. So the timing of this is extraordinary to say the least, because the enemy of the enemy is Assange, and yet they're relying upon him now to get credit points in their system. At the same time, Ukraine is now fully exposed. We're now getting stories of numbers of 100,000 soldiers dead in Ukraine, 5-1 against Russian soldiers. We've got the FTX Ponzi scheme debacle that's capturing all these politicians red-handed with dirty money. We've got Adam Schiff now going on CNN and complaining that he might get kicked off the Intelligence Committee, which of course would mean that he wouldn't be privy to information that may otherwise be classified and not accessible to him in all of this information that he desperately needs to know where the bodies are buried. And of course, all of this amongst admissions now from Pfizer executives about the vaccine failures in all of it. The wheels are coming off the establishment's bus at a rate of knots. And of course, out of all of that, the death of Evelyn de Rothschild 2 weeks ago, who was the grandfather of the whole movement, means that there is definitely something afoot here. Whilst the scoreboard may look 500-0 against, it's very much looking like the freedom fighters, the Patriots, are about to enter a penalty shootout here, and all of our players are fully fit and ready to take it on. And not to mix too many metaphors, but I feel a lot more confident than otherwise. Darren, before we go, who have you got on the show today?
I have Sarah Pumley. She is a teacher. She has left the education system. She's very similar to me. And we have fascinating conversations. And we'll be talking about Trump and Qatar and why people believe things that are obviously untrue. So we have fantastic conversations, me and Sarah. So please join me on Digging Deeper at 11 a.m.
Excellent. Well, I've got Tim Price coming up next. Going to take that break and introduce you to him in just a few moments. You're listening to TNT Radio.
Singer, songwriter, and keyboardist of Fleetwood Mac, Christine McVie, has died. Born in 1943, McVie was introduced to the piano from a young age and went on to join her first band, Chicken Shack, in 1967. The following year, she married Fleetwood Mac bassist John McVie, and a year after that, left Chicken Shack to eventually join Fleetwood Mac from 1970 on. Her first solo album, Christine Perfect, was released that year too. But it was her prolific work over the coming decades with Fleetwood Mac that brought her widespread international fame and acclaim. Christine was responsible for writing and singing on their biggest hits, Don't Stop, You Make Loving Fun, Little Lies, and Everywhere. Among countless accolades and records, she was a Grammy winner for their album of the year, Rumors, and also inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1998. We remember the legendary Christine McVie.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's news talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. The electric vehicle, saving the planet, killing children. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Tim Price is my next guest, and he is the director of Price Value Partners, a finance organization based out of London in the UK. He's the author of Investing Through the Looking Glass, A Rational Guide to Irrational Financial Markets, and also to a book called The War on Cash, which if you go onto his website, pricevaluepartners.com, you can actually download for free. It is outstanding, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. But in this insightful series of essays, first published in 2015, I'm just reading from the foreword, award-winning fund manager Tim Price reveals how the problems of 2008 haven't gone away. They've got worse. The real threat isn't just loss of money, says Tim, but a fundamental loss of freedom. As governments and central banks get more desperate to stave off disaster, they may yet turn to you and your money instead. This is what Tim calls financial martial law. Tim Price, welcome to the Jason Q Citizen and Friends program.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you, Tim. The book, The War on Cash, is such an eye-opener. You've written it so succinctly that it's one of those books that you can just open up. I mean, obviously, you want to start at the beginning and keep going, but at any point, you jump in, and within moments, you go, yes, that's right. Oh, wow, I didn't think of that. Yeah, it's one of those books. It's like idea, new idea, new idea. It consolidates what I was suspecting, and then it provides explanation that says, now I know what I know makes sense to me. You've taken out all the mystery, and you've just put it all together beautifully. Well done. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's very kind.
Now, when you start on the book, I mean, it's pretty obvious the idea of the restricting of cash, but why is it that cash is now the enemy of the people?
I mean, some of what's happened in the last 3 years has come after, you know, comfortably after the book was written, and there were things that have occurred around the world that I think probably most people could never have foreseen. But it's indicative of a general trend of basically freedom crushing around the world. So there's clearly something quite dark, I don't think it's exaggeration to use the word evil happening across the West, across most of the world. And what is symptomatic of this sort of malign trend is a slow throttling of individual and personal liberty.
But why
cash is, in a sense, in financial terms, is a personification of individual liberty, because it is, to use the technical jargon, it's a bearer security. So I'll put in a sort of Christmas reference. So in Die Hard, the stuff that the crooks are ultimately after are like millions and millions in bearer bonds. The meaning and the beauty of any bearer instrument is that the person who holds it has the value of the certificate. So cash is a bit like a form of money that doesn't pay any interest, but it gives value to the simple holder of it. So if you pay with anything in cash, you can pay what you like, to whom you like, for what you like, and the authorities have no sense of what value transfer is occurring. So it's the perfect, I mean, you could say it's crypto now, but before crypto we had cash, and cash was a perfectly anonymous way of transferring value between individuals.
So what then happens if we move to a proposed central bank digital currency and tracking? We now learn that in the Netherlands, their government is talking about a bill where they will trace all transactions over 100 euro and keep those records for 5 years. What happens in a world where people don't want their transactions recorded or, in fact, traced? How do they move beyond a compulsory central bank digital currency? Can that get off the ground? And will it form other ways of trading?
That's a very good question. So clearly central banks around the world are trialing this horrible anti-democratic, anti-freedom technology. And the most recent example I know is Nigeria, where I saw a Bloomberg piece the other day that suggested that after a trial, I don't know how long the trials lasted, but after a trial of CBDC in Nigeria, a grand total of 0.5% of the population were using this stuff. So nobody wants this except basically communistic technocrats, the sort of people who are embedded around institutions around the world who are responsible for, you know, some of what everyone is now suffering and has been since 2020 and the sort of the pandemic first got into gear. In terms of how you can opt out, it's an open question because we don't know exactly what terms CBDC may yet be used, if indeed it is ever rolled out, and ideally it will never be rolled out. But on the assumption that there is some form of central bank digital currency imposed on people or attempted to be imposed, one obvious thing is firstly to retain cash, even if it's only used in a sort of black market capacity. I think that the bottom line for me is I make no bones about being a libertarian. I believe in sort of individual liberty and freedom. And one of the most useful books I've come across in this topic, basically the topic being government never knows anything and government is always the enemy, is a book called 40 Centuries of Wage and Price Controls. The clue is in the title. So this is a book that you can get for free via the Mises website in the States, M-I-S-E-S, Mises.org. But essentially 40 centuries of wage and price controls shows you that for 4,000 years, governments and technocrats and bureaucrats have tried to implement wage and price controls, and it never works. And even if it does work, there's always unintended consequences. My favorite example from the book is something called the Edict of Diocletian. Now, the Edict of Diocletian occurred when the Emperor Diocletian in the last days of the Roman Empire was installed, or knowing the last days of the Roman Empire, probably murdered his way into the position, and then found mysteriously that because the Roman Empire was heavily overextended, it had military everywhere, it had no money, it was bankrupt. Does it sound at all familiar to you? Then he said, well, we need to control prices. We need to control basically spiraling grain prices, agricultural price in particular. So the Edict of Diocletian stipulated that, for example, grain prices would not rise on pain of death. And you know what happened? Grain prices still went up. So it, in a sense, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I'd like to think that CBDC never gets off the ground, but they're clearly trialing it because they're determined to try and impose this nonsense. But I'd like to think that even if it does get off the ground, firstly, no one will know. Those people who can opt out will opt out. Those people who don't need to use it will not use it. And in the meantime, maybe you have a secondary cash market from the old fiscal cash for those of us that have been wise enough to stockpile the stuff. Or maybe it's silver or gold. Or maybe it's we go back to the sort of cash transfer mechanisms that you get in prison. I mean, we've all been locked down for the last few years, so we're used to sort of the prison economy now. So what has value in prisons if you can't use money, traditional money? Well, you use cigarettes, you use matches, you use, you know, anything like that has some kind of soap, even maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a guy I know who has a business. He sells safes to individuals and companies, and I discussed the threat of CBDC with him about 2 years ago. And he said, look, if my clients can't pay me in pounds sterling or euros or US dollars, they'll pay me in gold or in cryptocurrency. You know, the market always finds a way. So it's easier said than done to just assume that central bank digital currency can be imposed and then we're all lumbered with it. That's clearly what they want to happen. But I think the reality is, for anyone that's lived in an overly intrusive governmental world, there's always a way. It's like in Jurassic Park, nature finds a way. Well, the market finds a way too. So I'm actually quite optimistic that whatever the worst dreams of sort of Davos man here, in terms of centralization and digital tracking and control, there will be an alternative. The market will find an alternative way of transferring value.
Well, you've provided me with two extraordinary confidence-building points, that one and, of course, the other one, that Nigeria has pretty much wholeheartedly rejected a central bank cryptocurrency in its trial. It's wonderful. We're going to pause for news headlines and come back with more here with Tim Price from Price Value Partners. Don't go anywhere. This is the interview you cannot afford to miss. This is TNT Radio.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with a check of your TNT headlines. The United States Space Force is working on developing an early warning system that'll track North Korean missile launches. Western news outlets and politicians have been blasted for their hypocrisy after praising Chinese citizens for pushing back against the government's COVID lockdowns while arresting and threatening to jail its own people who dared to do the same. And a court in Tokyo has ruled that Japan's ban on same-sex marriage is constitutional and therefore should be upheld.
Do you have a suggestion for a possible guest or host that you'd like to hear on TNT Radio?
Or perhaps you have a topic you feel we should discuss?
Then we want to hear from you. Simply complete the suggestion form on the TNT Radio website. Help us make a difference on TNT Radio.
From the book, The War on Cash, cash gives you the ability to do business with almost anyone, anywhere, at any time. Economists call that ability liquidity. Tim calls it freedom. And that's what this book is all about. even though I took that from the forward that Tim didn't write. If your cash is taken away from you, or if it is taxed by the bank or the government with a negative interest rate, it's not just an attack on the value of your money, it's an attack on your freedom. That attack is part of what Tim is talking about when he talks about financial martial law. Tim, how much trouble are we in today in 2022 compared to where we were in 2008? And we all saw the movie The Big Short. It was pretty bad then, and they predicted it at the end. But how much more time have we got in this current system?
Well, I'm looking at my watch now. It's 8:35 a.m. London time. Will we make it to lunchtime? Who knows?
It does feel like that, though, doesn't it?
As your colleagues over the water may know, I have a weakness for sort of cheesy old quotes, particularly from films. So there's a quote from, I think it's No Country for Old Men, and basically there's a scene fairly early on in the film where the sheriff and his deputy ride into the desert, and there's basically a drug deal gone bad, and there's basically dead dogs, smashed up cars, corpses, you know, littering the desert. And the deputy says, "Well, this is a mess, ain't it, sheriff?" And the sheriff responds, "Well, if it ain't a mess, it'll do till the mess gets here." That, I think, is where we are today. We are in a mess, and if it ain't a mess, it'll do till the mess gets here. So I cannot believe that. I mean, as you say, and you give a very generous plug to the book, The War on Cash. That book was written in 2015. It was published in 2015. I can't believe we're here 7 years later, nearly 8 years later, and it's taken this long for the crisis to metamorphosize into its current form. But to answer your question, how bad is and how bad could it get? And how close are we to the sort of denouement of this black comedy? It seems to me that we're closer to the end than to the beginning of the current monetary system. So that may sound alarmist. It's not meant to be. My colleague at the business, Killian Connolly, has studied monetary system regime change. And the reality is that the man being a fallen entity, our money always changes. Our monetary system always changes because we're fallen creatures. So the current monetary system or what passes for a monetary system globally basically began life in 1971 when President Nixon took the dollar off gold. So what that means is that prior to 71, dollars, US dollars and gold were freely convertible between each other. And in 71, basically, the U.S. was running out of gold reserves. So the combined cost of the welfare state, sort of the big society, and the cost of the Vietnam War meant that the foreign central banks were queuing up to liquidate their dollars and take gold in exchange. So Nixon stopped that in the infamous Nixon gold shock of 71. From that moment to now, all global currencies have not been tethered to anything tangible. Previously, there's a long-standing history of governments backing their currencies by gold. But that relationship was ended formally in 71. So since then, we've had basically a global currency system that's not been backed by anything. 08 then comes along, and you have a banking system that's basically bankrupt. So government steps in and bails out the banks using taxpayers' money. And a problem that could have been maybe resolved in 08... funnily enough, politicians choose to take the easier path. So two things could have happened in 08 during the Lehman crisis. One is that the government, the Fed specifically, the US authorities allowed Wall Street banks to fail. That would have been painful, but we would have had a reset of the system. But that's not what happened. Once they saw the damage that they'd done by letting Lehman go to the wall, they then bailed out everybody and they poured trillions into to save the system. But the problem is the system wasn't saved. It was simply the problem of too much indebtedness was simply kicked that can was kicked further down the road. So if they'd made tough decisions in 08, then maybe we wouldn't be in the place we are at now, but we're at the place we're at now. So the problem in its essence is that there is too much debt in the world, specifically too much government debt. That debt can never be repaid except in devalued money. So I think what we're now living through is what I think we're at the early stages of what the economist Mises, Ludwig von Mises, called the crack-up boom. The crack-up boom is when the man in the street suddenly realizes that the money printing is just never going to stop and that the purchasing power of his money is being just eroded on a daily basis. And it's at that point when the average guy or girl says, you know, stuff this for a game of soldiers. I want to convert my ever worthless cash, currency specifically, fiat currency, into something that will retain its value. And that's where you see a rush into things like gold, silver, property, tangible non-financial things, things that if you drop them on your foot, it tends to hurt, as opposed to purely financial paper fiat assets. So I think we're already well along that journey. But how long it takes, you know, as Adam Smith said, there's a great deal of ruin in a nation.
Such a interesting perspective, because the one thing that you didn't say in all of that was crypto, which of course is intangible, and yet it seems to have been the diversion between 2008 and today that's sucked out a whole lot of money, resulted in obviously the FTX collapse and all of a sudden a loss of confidence in a system that I've always suspected was some form of a Ponzi scheme, but was hoping that it wasn't. Can you put some perspective on the whole crypto in all of this?
I mean, crypto is a fascinating sector. Now, in the interest of full transparency, I should probably concede that we've yet to embrace crypto as a business. So that doesn't mean, I mean, individually, I'm not anti-cryptocurrency in any way, because, again, as a libertarian, I have to come to the conclusion that in currency terms, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Let there be as much choice as possible. Currency itself is far too important. Money is far too important to be left to politicians to control. But that, of course, is the tragedy of our time. So I think crypto fundamentally is a good thing. I don't claim to fully understand the technicalities. And clearly what's happened with the failure of FTX has blown a huge hole in the credibility of the whole system. Now, if you define crypto as basically Bitcoin, then I think Bitcoin still persists. I think Bitcoin's a survivor. And I think the blockchain technology is a big survivor and potentially one of the biggest value adds of the whole sort of proposition of cryptocurrency per se. But in terms of our take on crypto is that, you know, as Killian would say, it's neither land, labor, or capital. So it may be a fourth type of sort of maybe a capital hybrid, but to our way of thinking as things stand, it doesn't meet our requirement for being sort of money good in the same way that the likes of gold or silver would do.
It's interesting, because for mine, the only way I could ever get my head around crypto was that it was like a private central economy that was reliable upon the people that choose to take part in it to transact, but it was detached from a central bank system. But well,
the whole word that's most important in all this is decentralized. It's DeFi, decentralized finance. So the current system basically involves central banks issuing money, or government/central banks in collusion with each other, basically controlling the money supply and basically doing a pig's breakfast of trying to control inflation. Whereas decentralized finance, e.g. cryptocurrency and Bitcoin et al., allows people to transfer value between each other without the need for a financial intermediary. So as you can appreciate, that's terribly bad news for governments, and it's terribly bad news for conventional banks. And that, you can hear the world's smallest violin now playing in the background for them.
But it, by its design, therefore, it is organized, sophisticated bartering. What I don't understand is how you can create a crypto, trade in it, but not actually transact in it. And the value goes from a dollar or whatever it was when it started up to 60,000 US and back down to 15,000 US for a particular coin. And therefore it's traded like that. I never understood how it could have such exponential value growth. And if it went into a central bank digital currency, would it explode in value the same way? I would think not. It would simply trade against one currency's crypto versus another one.
I think, sorry to cut in, Jason, but I think in my head, the distinction between the two sort of propositions is that in a CBDC world, you don't even have a proper fair exchange, because a central bank digital currency can be programmable. It can be switched off on a whim, whereas things like the blockchain are a permanent public record of all the transactions that have taken place between the users of the cryptocurrency involved. So that's the key difference. One's a free market. So in other words, crypto or Bitcoin, if you like, is digital gold, whereas CBDC is just digital tyranny.
Yes. It's such an important distinction that you've been able to make there, given that if it's programmable, technically all it is a voucher system provided that you work for, but the government overrules you. So there's your tyranny right there. Now, in the book, if we just go back to the book for a moment, you talk about groupthink and those in power who make absurd decisions. For mine, it's absolutely profound, a comment. But can you talk about that in a bit more detail?
Sure. So I used to have a neighbor who was the economics editor of the magazine called The Investors Chronicle here in the UK. And he's moved up north now. So we don't live close by, but he introduced me to a book called Groupthink by the authors Irving L. Janus. And the original Groupthink book, which I think came out in the 60s, is a study basically of policy errors made by various US governments over time. And there are things like the decision to invade the Bay of Pigs in Cuba, the decision to escalate the war in Vietnam. They tend to be basically, you know, fluffed up military, you know, disasters. But the common thing they have is that they all arose as a result basically of the following thing happening. The president would march into a meeting of his sort of senior star chamber and would say, right, guys, here's the problem. What I think we should do is X. Now you tell me what we should do. And the problem with that is once the president's tipped his hand, everyone falls into line. Nobody's going to naysay, you know, the commander-in-chief. No one's going to naysay that the diktat of the most powerful man on the planet. So because of our natural tendency to be tribal in outlook, groupthink occurs, and therefore whatever the merit in the presidential perspective, the chances are the group, the committee, is just going to keep reinforcing itself, reinforcing its zeal to be loyal to that position until they just manage to just cock everything up. The beauty of the book is it shows that JFK, because he's involved in a lot of this stuff, showed that he could learn from his own mistakes. So the way this ultimately transpired was that JFK, for it was he, I think, that effectively originated the whole concept of groupthink by the example of his committee, that, you know, his trusted advisors. What he would then do is he'd come into the meeting of his, you know, senior executive and say, okay, here's the problem. Tell me what you think we should do, and then I'll weigh in at the end. And that's a crucial distinction. You allow if you have a committee of anything, you allow the committee to speak and discuss, and then the person who's in charge of that committee weighs in at the end and not the beginning.
So interesting, isn't it, that whilst JFK looked like the original villain there in the groupthink analysis of the Bay of Pigs, but he managed to work it out on the other side of it. Now, we're going to take a break and we'll come back. I've got many more questions. I don't know how many we're going to fit in, but we're here with Tim Price from Price Value Partners. You're listening to TNT Radio.
We're saved. Climate activist Greta Thunberg is suing her native country of Sweden for failing to make the climate better.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Greta Thunberg has been joined by 600 plaintiffs in the Swedish case. Greta is suing the Swedish government for, quote, insufficient climate action. Greta claims that the state of Sweden has carried out climate policy that, quote, threatens our human rights. It breaks the law. So Greta Thunberg actually believes that a lawsuit forcing the Swedish government to act on climate will result in an improved climate? Less storminess? Humans used to believe that witchcraft trials would bring about less crop failure and less food shortages during the Middle Ages. The question looms. Have we advanced since medieval times? Yes, you too can sue your government to improve the weather. What a novel concept. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
In this day and age, everybody deserves the right to access phone and internet services. Whether you're from regional, rural or remote Australia, the Regional Tech Hub can independently assist with providing advice on connectivity options in your local area, or work with you and your service provider to resolve outstanding issues with phone and internet. And our service is absolutely free. Find out more by visiting regionaltechhub.org.au or by calling 1300 081 029. RTH is an initiative of the Australian Government delivered by the NFF.
Turn on Alexa and ask her to play
TNT Radio.
Turning on anything else usually requires dinner and conversation, dressing up and brushing your teeth, and I'm already tired.
This is today's news talk
and the voice of freedom.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back. Tim, you talk about the global threat of central planning in your book. Can you tell us a bit more about what you mean?
Yeah, I find it astonishing that after the epic failures of state, big state planning in the 20th century, that we're now moving even even more rapidly towards a sort of centralized, it seems that we're moving ever more rapidly towards some kind of centralized world government, despite the fact that these systems never have never worked and can never ever work. And all they do create is basically misery and the premature deaths of millions of people. So see, for example, the fate of the Soviet Union or the Chinese Communist Party, or, you know, they're invariably communistic in some form. But I find it quite amazing that, I mean, the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, and I think then Francis Fukuyama wrote The Death of History, as if, you know, Western capitalism, free market capitalism had won the battle. Well, those celebrations were clearly premature. So again, we're coming back to the same kind of messages and themes that the likes of Ludwig von Mises, the great Austrian, or if you prefer, classical economist, spoke about over the last 100 years, which is, you know, if you want a society and an economy to run well, you leave it well alone, and you let entrepreneurs do their stuff, and you let people transact freely. And that's a sort of libertarian fantasy in a sense, because we're so far away from that now. We don't have proper capitalism. We have crony capitalism. And we have what increasingly looks like some kind of fascistic merger of bad mega corporate interests with government. And arguably the CCP is at the heart of all of this stuff now. But either way, there's two ways of basically running an economy and running a society. One is that you let the free market do its stuff. So government should be as small as humanly possible, and it basically is there to keep the streetlights on, and maybe that's it. Maybe that should be the extent of its powers. And then for everything else, you let the system work, you let the free market system work. But we're going in exactly the opposite direction. So the whole COVID plandemic crisis has shown that the big state is back, and that's been a complete disaster in economic terms, in health terms, in every conceivable way. So central planning has been, is, and always will be an unmitigated disaster. So we should do everything we possibly can to try and prevent that mission creep from metastasizing.
Yeah, and it seems to be metastasizing in a very, very novel way, which is artificial intelligence and the idea of building robots that will replace labor in many areas. This has been talked about in great detail by the World Economic Forum. Yuval Harari, who acts as one of their advisors, and he talks about that humans are themselves becoming redundant. And despite Elon Musk showing us that he supports free speech, he's out there now telling us that his Neuralink AI chip is ready to go for testing and through the FDA of all things. It's quite unbelievable. Do you see that this connection to AI is in a way the central planners, perhaps through World Economic Forum, as a way to move into a whole new economy that would require less people by design? Harari's already said that, as I just mentioned. And I find this incredibly disturbing, that we are literally making ourselves wholly redundant in all of this and not realizing it at the same time.
Yeah, there is a creepy transhumanism at the heart of everything that comes out of Davos and has been for at least the last 3 years. It's a particular shame in relation to Harari, because Harari wrote an excellent book called Sapiens a few years ago, which is one of my favorite books. And that really is all about the power of narrative. But since then, he seems to have completely lost his mind. But the transhumanist agenda is malicious and actively evil. And is certainly not in the interests of the free market, the family, or God.
This is the point, isn't it? It's all of those things, and also against the family as well, which seems to be eroded at the same time. I made the point earlier in my introduction that perhaps it is the trans agenda that is the softening of society in terms of its permissiveness, the idea that suddenly you can select your own gender, as we're all aware of, without having any science to back it. It's the science of thought, as opposed to the science of science. So we're moving down again a split in the system in all of this. It's quite confronting, but it's because of this that it means that if we're going to accept this, then tomorrow we're going to accept that a sentient AI has to be given the same rights as a human being, and in the process we become competitive with an AI for whatever it is, our job, our income. And of course, they're going to be able to do it better than a human being, and they do it for less. They're not going to need to eat. They're not going to need to sleep. There's many things that a transhuman versus an AI hasn't really got much of a chance. I feel like this whole agenda can only ever last one generation before we've turned the planet into an episode of Westworld.
Well, my own take is that, I mean, these people are basically criminals, psychopaths or sociopaths, and I suspect most of them will end their days in a military prison. That's my hope and expectation.
Yeah, well, it is mine too. And so it's very interesting that you've made the point, like I'll go back on with the Nigeria. That's an article that I'm going to obviously look up. It gives me such hope. Now, in the book, you've also talked about a concept called mission creep. I should say mission creep. And my own take on this was that when Charles Ortel performed an audit on the Clinton Foundation, which was only ever set up to build a presidential library, he, of course, uncovered that it had gone off into so many different areas that it wasn't permitted to be involved with. Mission creep talks about something similar when a project expands beyond the first goal set for it. Can you explain this in terms of the global picture at the moment?
Yeah, I think we used the term metastasis earlier in relation to the sort of cancerous spread of bad ideas. And I think the same applies to pretty much everything that's comes from the world of politics. So the way that the sort of Western style politics works, especially in the States, sadly, is that you have a bill and then everyone loads and loads more and more pork into that bill until a bill with originally a very modest agenda suddenly comes out to have all these kind of side aspects and addenda and notes that basically they completely change the you know the nature of whatever the original legislative agenda was into something that has, you know, billions and billions and billions of sort of extra boondoggle dollars added to it just because that's what happens when politicians write law. There's mission creep. So you start with something that may have the best of intentions and you end up with a pork barrel policy that's just loaded to the gunnels with basically vested interests. And I think the one thing that is such a shame about the sort of, let's say, the replacement of Trump with the sort of the Biden crime family is that it just reveals that the naked greed of a political class is interested purely in its own self-aggrandizement.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, with the advent of the BRICS currency around the world, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and other countries are now sort of lining up to get involved, and you've got Turkey talking about pulling out of NATO, etc. I read an article out yesterday from Australia's largest bullion provider, ABC Bullion, where they said they broke down the amount of gold that's being purchased by around the world, and China and India seem to be leading the way in all of this. How do you see that gold's value in terms of perhaps a new currency, or if the BRICS currency starts, why is gold and silver so suppressed in value today? It seems that with all the inflation going on, you would have expected a pickup, but we don't see it. What's going on in the world of bullion, Tim?
Without wishing to sound too much like a conspiracy theorist, I would suggest that the price of gold and silver has been artificially suppressed by the very people who are acquiring it. So, which is central banks, not least. So it recently emerged, for example, that the Bank for International Settlements, which is an organization often called the Central Bank's Central Bank, had just bought 500 tons of gold. Now, these guys aren't stupid. They may be evil, but they're not stupid. So the chances are that they will do everything in their power to manipulate the price lower before they actually take delivery of said gold. That's unlike, say, our Gordon Brown, who was our infamous sort of chancellor who decided to sell most of the UK's gold reserves at the absolute low in the price in the history of the gold price back in the late 90s. Anyway, be that as it may. So I think the price is almost certainly suppressed, but it's not as if gold or silver are unique in this. And we lately observed that their price is actually on a bit of a tear higher, and we think that's got a lot further to go. And it all comes back to this issue of debt. If you ultimately expect the global debt pyramid to collapse, then that also involves the collapse of all fiat currencies and the likely resurgence of some form of new monetary system. Now, the central banks may want that to be CBDC, but I would prefer it to be something that was ideally gold-backed. So I mentioned some monetary system regime change earlier. Monetary systems actually change all the time. So the current one, this sort of fiat cobbled together standard, has been with us for 50 years, but it's already showing quite clearly that it's creaking at the seams. I think particularly in the context of the BRICS, as you say, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, sort of emerging world nexus, if you like, there's a very high likelihood that any currency that those countries look to use could well be in part commodities or even gold backed. So there's a question we've asked our clients religiously for the last few years, basically as a sort of as a thought experiment. It's a three-part quiz. Which country in the world is the largest miner of gold?
Which is?
China. Which country in the world doesn't allow an ounce of its gold to be exported?
China.
Which country in the world has advised all of its citizenry to own gold?
There you go. Wow, China. Amazing.
I think there's a message in there somewhere.
Certainly is. What a wonderful way to end a brilliant conversation, Tim Price. It's been a delight to have you on the program, and I'm certainly going to work out a way to get you back on, because there's so much more we need to discuss. Up next, Rick Munn is Locked and Loaded, and that will follow immediately after the news. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to TNT Radio.